Well, the thing, the whole darn thing is concealed in a cute little statement in here, which gives us a key. I'll give it to you. They're talking about the problems of the Lucifer Rebellion. Page 618, paragraph 3. It's the 12th reason they give for delay. They say time, even in a universe of time, is relative. If a rancher mortal of average length of life should commit a crime which precipitated worldwide pandemonium, and if he were apprehended, tried, and executed within 2 or 3 days of the commission of the crime, would it seem a long time to you? And yet that would be nearer a comparison with the length of Lucifer's life, even if his adjudication, now begun, should not be completed for 100,000 Urantia years. It's been 200,000 years since the rebellion. If it goes another 100, there's where I get my 300,000 years. The relative lapse of time, from the viewpoint of Uversa, where the litigation is pending, could be indicated by saying that the crime of Lucifer was being brought to trial within 2.5 seconds of its commission. From the paradise viewpoint, the adjudication is simultaneous with the enactment. Now, if you pry the stuff out and associate it, then you can make something better than a silly guess as to how old Orvantan is. I don't know that this figure's right, but it's not silly anyway. And it's an awful big number. 40,000 times as old as Andronover, and Andronover is 1 trillion years of age. Do you realize that the number 1 trillion is larger even than our national debt? And that's a very formidable number. Our national debt...
Just give us a couple of years.
Our national debt is hovering just under 0.3 trillion. And I don't expect in our lifetime it'll get to 1 trillion.
Many might say, gee, it was ultimate already. I don't know if the Democrats stand it.
I sure am glad I'm awake. You can live in peace with everyone.
It's taking a bunch of ages and this and that. Well, it's just ahead of it. The Lucifer problems of the rebellion.
Yes.
That I was telling you about a while ago about what would have been had it not.
Yes.
They keep mentioning dispensation.
Yes. The dispensations vary.
Of an age, yes. All
dispensations
right.
Vary in length. The first dispensation on our planet was about 500,000 years. From the appearance of Andon and Fonda to the arrival of the planetary prince. The second dispensation was about 460,000 years from the arrival of the prince to the arrival of Adam. The third dispensation was about 35,000 years from the arrival of Adam until the appearance of Jesus. We are now in the fourth dispensation, which has been humping along about 1,900 years. Now they seem to be getting shorter, but I don't know whether that's any criteria or not.
Well, we're speeding up for thinking.
Mm-hmm.
We're speeding up for evolution. We're speeding up in mechanical age and every age.
Sure. Who was it says we broke the old barrier about 1830, and then we broke the sound barrier in 1945. I like that. We broke the old barrier. Well, that's when we got to go faster than horses would go. Do you have any more questions?
Well, we wanted to know if associative is in the pre-zero age. You know, back with the three circles.
Yes, I think so. Wait a minute now. That's the function of total deity. Yeah, I think you've got an associative function there. You've got it in the Trinity, too. You've got it in Father, Son, and Spirit in the Zero Age.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to pinpoint these things.
But you have a transition zone.
Yeah.
You have a transition from the Trinity into the dawn of the first universe age and right back at it.
Yeah. That's right. There's a twilight zone. The papers speak, for example, of the near times of eternity. And they speak of the dawn of time. And there is a thing called twilight, which would be very difficult. Is it, well, when you enter the core of the finality, have you completed the paradise ascent or have you begun something larger? This is graduation commencement? I think it's a matter of perspective. When you get to Jerusalem, in a way you've assured survival. But you're an awful freshman.
But you just finished the game on the 1,000-yard field.
Let me read you what the papers have to say on that point. It's a very, it's a lovely little bit in here. Yeah, and you should see me. You should see me go to pieces when I can't find it. They're talking here about Supreme Seraphim, page 428. Paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Universe Orientators. These are the true friends and postgraduate counselors of all those ascending creatures who are pausing for the last time on Salvington in the universe, in their universe of origin, as they stand on the brink of the spirit adventure stretching out before them in the vast super universe of Orvandan. And at such a time, many an ascender has a feeling which mortals could understand only by comparison with the human emotion of nostalgia. Behind lie the realms of achievement, realms grown familiar by long service and Marantia attainment. Ahead lies the challenging mystery of a greater and vaster universe. It is the task of the universe orientators to facilitate the passage of the ascending pilgrims from the attained to the unattained level of universe service, to help these pilgrims in making those kaleidoscopic adjustments to the comprehension of meanings and values inherent in the realization that a first stage spirit being stands not at the end and climax of the local universe Marantia ascent, but rather at the very bottom of the long ladder of spiritual ascent to the Universal Father on Paradise.
We're always on the bottom, aren't we? We're always starting.
That's right.
We can't get any further up. I like that. I
know. That's right.
They give us time to take a shower and sit down and reflect.
Mm-hmm.
We can have a cup of coffee, too.
They never move us. They never move you on in a hurry.
What page were you reading?
Page
428.
Paragraph
4 and 5.
They say in two different places in the papers, they say that with all of this endless journey, we are never deprived of the feeling of attainment. That every now and then there comes a time when universe horizons stand still. And we, instead of being freshmen, we have the fun of being graduates. And they let us enjoy that. You see, when you get to Jerusalem, just to pick the first one of these, you're a citizen now. You've gotten somewhere. You've got status. And I suspect you do a lot of growing. You remember, you vote in accordance with your attainment. You start out with one vote, and you can get up to 1,000 votes, depending on your maturity. And
you can step it out of that?
You don't have to up there. And I suspect that the first indication that you want to be a freshman again comes when you begin to get itchy feet. You're not basking in the joy of survival. You're beginning to get a little bored. A little, I've done this before, you know. I've taught this class 20 times before. And then I think this is the first indication that it's time to move on. You've finished your Jerusalem tour of duty. You better move on to the satellites of Edentia.
You don't want to move on, are you?
Ma'am?
You've taught this class 20 times.
No, I didn't mean that. But you've got a class on Jerusalem you've taught 20 times. It's high time that you move then. You see, I think we'll alternate between the satisfaction of achievement and the reawakening of the desire for adventure. And I don't think they're ever going to shove us. I don't think they're going to push us off Jerusalem. I think they're going to wait until we've had satisfaction of being citizens.
Still, it's my guess that they had 20 times to
come up
again to be the number of times.
Oh, of course. I suspect that's right.
20 times, kind of.
Quite like.
What's that quote you take to the sweetness of success?
Yes. I think I can find that. Let's see. It's the most unlikely place. I think it's in Supreme and Ultimate.
Oh, that's awful little jewel for the unlikely place.
It's in here in two places. Yes. It's on page 1294. Next to the last paragraph. They're talking about the fact that mathematics gives you an approach to infinity. Because no matter how big a number you think of, you can still add some. And no matter how large the number conceived, you can always envisage one more being added. And you also can comprehend that this is still short of infinity. For no matter how many times you repeat this addition to number, still always one more can be added. At the same time, the infinite series can be totaled at any given point. And this total, more properly a subtotal, provides the fullness of the sweetness of goal attainment for a given person at a given time and status. But sooner or later, this same person begins to hunger and yearn for new and greater goals. And such adventures of growth will be forever forthcoming in the fullness of time and the cycles of eternity. Soul and the divine adjuster are finally and eternally fused, each gains all of the experience experienceable qualities of the other. Please note that word, experienceable. It doesn't mean that you can immediately take in all the adjuster has to offer. Because your capacity is limited. If you're a pint, you can take in a pint of what the adjuster has to offer. Later on, you'll become a quart. In between, you'll traverse the experience of being a fifth.
Prior to that, you'll be a half pint.
That's right.
Now look at me when you say that.
When the evolving soul and the divine adjuster are finally and eternally fused, each gains all of the experienceable qualities of the other. This coordinate personality possesses all of the experiential memory of survival once held by the ancestral mortal mind and then resident in the Maranchus soul. And in addition thereto, this potential finality embraces all of the experiential memory of the adjuster throughout the mortal indwellings of all time. But it will require an eternity of the future for an adjuster ever completely to endow the personality partnership with the meanings and values which the divine monitor carries forward from the eternity of the past. Now, that can mean, I think, just one thing, and that is that while we are engaged in the exploration of God on the outside, we're also engaged in the qualitative exploration of the Father fragment on the inside. And you can no more finish one than you can finish the other. It'll take eternity for man to grow the capacity to perceive, to receive what the adjuster has to offer.
Well, he's a fragment of God.
Yeah.
And we're not going to even experience
it,
knowing God.
Okay. You're lucky you're not having a lot of experience.
The thing that intrigues me, too, on page 1237, paragraph 4, it says, thought adjuster fusion, 1237, paragraph 4, thought adjuster fusion imparts eternal actualities to personality, which were previously only potential. Among these new endowments may be mentioned fixation of divinity quality, past eternity experience and memory, immortality, and a phase of qualified potential absoluteness. This isn't the full inventory. These are merely some of the things they choose to mention from what the adjuster contributes. Fixation of divinity quality. To me, that simply means that what do you do when you put a dyed object in a fixer? It means it won't fade or run anymore. You've made a final choice. And fusion fixes that choice. You first made it final. And since you have made it final, the adjuster fixates it. When you fuse with your thought adjuster, you will never again sin. You might perform an evil thing because you're imperfect. You could be less than wise. But you would never deliberately embrace evil. You would never again consciously be disloyal to God. Never. Past eternity, experience, and memory. Yeah, but I don't think you can take in any more of that than you've experienced. I think as you move forward in time, you're also moving backward in time. I've theorized in our story here I've theorized that man is emerging from time on his own, twice as fast as time passes. And here's the reasoning that I offer you. If you've lived, let's just pick any age. Let's say that maturity starts at 20, and we'll forget the first 20 years. Let's say by age 30, you've had 10 years of conscious life as an adult. You should be able to forecast 10 years then, shouldn't you? This gives you a 20-year time base. And from there on, you gain 2 for 1, right? Now, if you fuse with your thought adjuster can open up to you as much as you can comprehend. So I would say, let's say you're on the fifth mansion world and you're 5,000 years old, conscious, mature life. If you're 5,000 years old, I think you got a time base for thinking purposes and planning purposes of 10,000 years. 5,000 years of memory, you can plan ahead another 5,000 years. That gives you a meaningful recognition of time of 10,000 years. This is how much of what the adjuster offers you, I think, you can appreciate. So to your 10,000 years will be added another 10,000 years. Now you have a time base of 20,000 years. So I think you're emerging from time 4 times as fast as time is passing. We estimated that the age of the master universe would be on the order of 5 trillion ATUs, right? If we grow from now until then, and since that number is so much larger than 50,000 ATUs, we can ignore the past of Orvandan, it's trivial. But if we have lived for 5 trillion ATUs, we should be able to think in terms of 20 trillion ATUs, or 4 times the age of the master universe. And this, I think, is how a creature quantitatively emerges from time into eternity. Qualitatively, this happens in the last transit from the inner circle of Havona to paradise. There's your quantitative emergence, qualitative emergence. Quantitatively, I just think you outlive time. If your grasp of time increases at 4 times the rate of the passage of time, then I think sooner or later you'll be able to think in a quasi-eternal fashion. Anybody who could think in terms of 20 trillion ATUs, the difference between that and eternal thinking to me is negligible from this point of perspective anyway.
Bill, let me clarify one thing.
Yeah.
Go back to that figure that is comprehensible to me. 5 years from now, a possible mortal will fuse with his adjuster.
Yeah.
At that time, that mortal has 5,000 years of experience.
He's lived 5,000 years. He should be
based
able to,
on that, he can project mentally 5.
Yeah.
That's 10. And at the point of fusion, then the additive of fusion gives him an additional 10?
Gives him access to past eternal memory, of which I think he can comprehend another 10,000 years.
Well, now, is it that why does he get an additive at that moment of fusion?
Oh, well, let's say shortly thereafter.
Well, I mean, no argument on that tonight.
Yeah. Because it's all available, but he can only scoop up as much as his... he can't scoop up anything that won't go into his container.
He's capable of swallowing mentally 10,000 years.
Yeah, so he
so
gets
he
10.
Therefore gets an additional 10,000
yeah.
in mental capacity.
Yeah.
In spiritual and so forth.
The more is there, but he can't apprehend
yes.
it.
Unfathomable wealth is there.
Sure.
But he can...
He's got a 10,000-year container.
He can masticate 10,000 more.
Yeah.
Giving him 20.
That's right.
After all, and he's only enjoyed 5,000.
That's right. He's growing at the rate of 41 on the passage of time, I think.
41 on his own. Well, eventually that will merge into...
I don't care how old it is, you're going to catch up with it sometime.
Yes, it will.
Do you think that we will ever be not conscious of time?
No.
I mean, we've always recognized that we have lived in time and been in time.
We'll never lose anything we had.
Nothing?
Well, anything useful. Anything of value. No, I think we'll always understand time.
I thought
and I think
mean we cannot transcend it, but we will always be conscious of it.
We'll, I think we'll someday transcend it, too.
Yes, I mean, I think...
In other words, we'll have a gear shift. Low gear, low, middle, and high. Where the middle gear is the transcendental gear. I think we'll always be able to think in terms of temporal sequence. Something which a thought adjuster can't do.
But it's a necessity, obviously, or we would be conscious.
Right, but I think even when we move beyond the finite, we will retain finite understanding. We'll simply add on something. I think when Michael visits an inhabited world, he can still see that world with the eyes of Jesus. I don't think anybody has to say to him, now what we're looking at here is a beautiful sunrise. But if a divine counselor visits an inhabited world, he sees none of this. A mighty messenger would, though, because he was one time immortal. Let's complete our inventory. Immortality. Well, this we should understand. And a phase of qualified potential absoluteness. What does that mean? Well, let's go over to the fourth part of this paper where they talk about personality. Over on page 1226. Next to the last paragraph, they say that we've got a personality. Right now, which has a potential of 7 dimensions. And that dimensions 4, 5, and 6 are totally non-expressive, expressible on the finite level. They define one dimension, 1, 2, and 3, as equaling length, vertical depth, and breadth. And in other words, these are aspects of personality, growth of personality, growth of the expression of personality. They say that dimension 7 on the finite level is simply a totalizing dimension. So when we get to the absonite level, then dimensions 4, 5, and 6 will begin to unfold, and dimension 7 will continue to be a totalizing level. But if we can ever go beyond the absonite level, dimension 7 will cease to be a totalizing level. And they say that this supreme dimension of personality is an associable absolute, and while not infinite, is dimensionally potential for sub-infinite penetration of the absolute. That tells me that we can get onto the third level of the firehouse. We get the equipment. And that's what this phase of qualified potential absoluteness means. To this dimension of personality, the thought adjuster adds his complement. And I don't think anything can stop us. Human beings are wound up in potential for all eternity. Right now, we have the equipment. Personality plus the thought adjuster. You see, when you fuse with a thought adjuster, you take on a gas tank that's never going to run out. That's right. Sub which?
Suborbital flight.
Yes.
And evidently Russia made orbital flight.
Mm-hmm.
It was not stopped. It went into orbit. I bet you the same idea when he was in France.
Sure. That's right. Well, human beings, I think, are God has given us full equipment. And when you against this background, now let me read you something you've read before. But think about it against this background. You can read these papers on so many levels. And the more you bring to each sentence. Page 71. Capacity for divine personality is inherent in the pre-personal adjuster. Capacity for human personality is potential in the cosmic mind endowment of the human being. But the experiential personality of mortal man is not observable as an active and functional reality until after the material life vehicle of the mortal creature has been touched by the liberating divinity of the Universal Father, being thus launched upon the seas of experience as a self-conscious and a relatively self-determinative and self-creative personality. The material self is truly and unqualifiedly personal.
What are you talking about, a soul? Larry?
They're talking about us. The material self is truly and unqualifiedly personal. The material self has personality and identity, temporal identity. The pre-personal spirit adjuster also has identity, eternal identity. This material personality and this spirit pre-personality are capable of so uniting their creative attributes as to bring into existence the surviving identity of the immortal soul. And here's the great statement. Having thus provided for the growth of the immortal soul, and having liberated man's inner self from the fetters of absolute dependence on antecedent causation, the Father stands aside. Now, man having thus been liberated from the fetters of causation response, you can make your own choices. You don't have to do what heredity and environment says, absolutely. And this is true, at least as pertains to eternal destiny, and provision having been made for the growth of the immortal self, the soul, it remains for man himself to will the creation, or to inhibit, deny the creation of this surviving and eternal self, which is his for the choosing. No other being, force, creator or agency in all the wide universe of universes can interfere to any degree with the absolute sovereignty of the mortal free will as it operates within the realms of choice regarding the eternal destiny of the personality of the choosing mortal. As pertains to eternal survival, God has decreed the sovereignty of the material and mortal will, and that decree is absolute. And at the bottom of the page, God provides for the sovereign choice of all true personalities. No personal creature can be coerced into the eternal adventure. The portal of eternity opens only in response to the free will choice of the free will sons of the God of free will.
Yeah, all the time. I mean, it's thought of just to respond, to push it there, to make it choice.
Sure. There's a great comparison made between the mortal being as a craft, a ship, of which the adjuster is pilot, and the personality is captain. The pilot knows the course from here to paradise, having traversed it at least once. But the pilot can pilot that ship only in accordance with the captain's decision. You know, when you read back in the adjuster papers and read up in here, doesn't it mean more to you? No. Look, the lower you are, the more you can grow. God indwells only the lowest of his creatures. I think it's a solitary messenger writing about thought adjusters who says, there's no one in the universe that wouldn't delight to be hosts to these mystery monitors. But he doesn't indwell the highborn. He indwells the lowest of these creatures. The portal of eternity opens only in response to the free will choice of the free will sons of the God of free will. It seems to me that the Father is trying to establish a universe in which love will be as integrating in relation to people as gravity is controlling in relation to matter. One of the authors, I guess it's one of the authors of one of the first five papers says, I think we would love God just as much were he divested of all his powers of infinity. We love God more for what he is than for what he does. This, of course, is the essence of worship in contrast to prayer. When you worship, you love. When you pray, you express need. So how about it, fellow mammals?
You made a statement. You expressed need. Someplace here, seems that I read, it's silly to say anything about need. That's up to you.
Oh, I think you've got a right to ask God for anything you want.
If he is our Father, we would ask our Father for what we need.
How many of you have had children in college who were always sure to write when they needed money? Well, that's better than not hearing from them, isn't it? Were you ever angered when they wrote you? Of course not. No, it's awful nice to get a letter when they...
Only 2 days after you send a check.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's nice to get a letter when they don't want anything, too. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I've had that experience. That's communication on the human level.
On the human level. All right.
But it's right friendly, if you know what I mean.
Well, did I get the wrong idea then from this thing?
Obviously.
No, I know exactly, George, what you are going
they
to
say. Many things. Here. They say many things in many ways. It says your Father knows what you need before you ask
That's
him.
What I was going to say.
But many times it does your soul good to ask him. Man's prayers don't change God, but they sure have a mighty beneficial effect on man. Certainly.
Well, it gives you an assurance. If God knows, for instance, what you need, and yet you ask for it, you have, when you receive it, it gives you an assurance of God's connection.
Right.
Of course, I don't think you get everything you ask for.
No.
I think you eventually do, but maybe not in this world.
It may not be in the form you ask for it.
No, not in the form you ask for it.
But which
it may be in God's time, which is no time other than our time, which is limited.
It does you good to say to God, I love you. And I don't think, God knows what's in your heart. But it does man good to express what's in his heart. Which wife, knowing that her husband loves her, is annoyed to be told of the fact? Or vice versa. It's good to communicate. Now, when you pray, consider the consequences of prayer. They can be almost horrifying. Let's say that you pray a very ethical, even a spiritual prayer, and with all your heart, you say to God, make me more useful. That's a good prayer to pray, isn't it? Make me more serviceable to my fellow men. Do you realize that you are signing blank checks which your seraphim can fill in?
But if you love God, you don't mind.
I know, but you may not be happy at what happens. Peter wanted to serve, didn't he? And Jesus saw in Peter a lethal weakness, an unthinking desire for immediate approval, to be one of the boys. And so Jesus let Peter go through an experience in Caiaphas' courtyard designed to cure Peter of that weakness and to make Peter a much more trustworthy shepherd of the sheep. But I don't think Peter enjoyed that experience. And if you do pray to be serviceable, to be of greater worth to your fellow men, just remember, you are signing blank checks, and the person that will probably fill those checks in is your group or individual guardian seraphim. For it says, let not your sloth or indolence tempt your guardian angel. For it says, let not your sloth or indolence tempt your guardian angel to lead your feet into devious paths for the good of your soul. You see, a seraphim wouldn't particularly care about your temporal ease if such temporal ease in any way jeopardized the chances of your survival. Your seraphim would be concerned with making things reasonably difficult and rugged. And again, I've used this illustration. Let's paint two pictures of primitive man. Let's get a Cro-Magnon because they're better looking, you know. And we've got a Cro-Magnon that hasn't eaten for 5 days. And this Cro-Magnon is crouched on the limb of a tree overhanging a trail. And there's a deer coming up this trail. I want you to consider this human being. Every muscle is etched in his body. This is a poem of concentration. This is man as near physical beauty as he ever comes. Man intent on accomplishing a purpose. Every line in that figure is clean. The spear you can see raised, only going to be one cast. You're not going to miss either. But every bit of cunning, every bit of experience he's got is mobilized. Here's a man in action, a hungry man. Now, consider him. 2 hours later, he's asleep. His belly is swelled beyond recognition, and the flies are buzzing around his face. Here is a contented man. Now, where is the beauty in the two pictures? Man with a problem or man contented? I say man with a problem is much more inspiring than man without a problem.
Yes, to look at, but to him it wouldn't.
Oh, of course not. Of course not. Yes, the hunt is much more artistic than the digestive process. Yes.
Well, the latter is would be more appreciated by the fly.
Right. Right. From the fly's viewpoint, the second picture's the better one.
From the man's view, my viewpoint, I like the other one.
If you were an artist now, which would you pick to paint?
Depends on whether you can paint men or flies.
That's right. You've got a point.
George.
I think.
May, you go back there.
Boy! Go on.
Oh, dear.
I think we might read something here just for kicks.
We almost did there, Kemosabe.
On page 1305, paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4, paragraph 5. Some of the amazingly fortuitous conditions occasionally prevailing on the evolutionary world may be due to the gradually emerging presence of the Supreme. The foretasting of his future universe activities. They're talking about providence here. Most of what a mortal would call providential is not. His judgment of such matters is very handicapped by lack of far-sighted vision into the true meanings of the circumstances of life. Much of what a mortal would call good luck might really be bad luck. The smile of fortune that bestows unearned leisure and undeserved wealth may be the greatest of human afflictions. The apparent cruelty of a perverse fate that heaps tribulation upon some suffering mortal may in reality be the tempering fire that is transmuting the soft iron of immature personality into the tempered steel of real character. Which picture is a beautiful picture? Don't ask the Cro-Magnon man to vote because he's got a conflict of interest in this matter. See, he's hungry. Of course we are. You see, the big deal is is making it. If you make it, any other deficiency is minor. And if you don't, no other asset is of any significance whatsoever. Yes. It is my will that your will be done.
My will is God's will if we want to do it. And if we can do anything you wish.
I think so.
Well, we do.
I have this opinion about God's will, and I offer it very, very tentatively to you. This is my own view. I think God's will is much larger than we're wont to recognize. I don't think God particularly cares what we do for a living. I think he is quite concerned with how we do for a living. I think he's, I don't think he particularly cares what we eat or,
What we drink.
Jesus said we get messed up not by what goes in the mouth, but by what comes out. Yes, man is defiled not by what enters into the mouth, but by what proceedeth forth from the mouth. I don't think we should look for a formula. The papers tell us that when they talk about the bestowal sons and their careers on the mortal worlds, they all do different things. They have many different vocations. But as you look at not the details of Jesus' life, but the principles of Jesus' life, he was constructive in all of his relationships with men. The term to do good to others is a bit hackneyed. The term do-gooder is hardly complimentary. In my own vocabulary, I rephrase this as an effort to be constructive in your relationship to your fellow man. Was this person helped through knowing you? So seldom in life, I think, we encounter whites and blacks. Most of our whole life experience has to do with discriminating between relative shades of gray. We never choose the good in the presence of the bad. Most of the time, I think, we're choosing the lesser evil in the presence of the greater evil. This we can do, though. This we have the equipment to do. And then again, to use what you have. The parable of the talents, the parable of the pounds. Jesus comments to Peter, which in essence says, look, there's been quite an investment made in you, old boy. Now pay out, will you please? Or in more familiar terms, be a good shepherd. What have you got to work with? Do it. Use it. Grow. Realize. The whole of your capacity. Consider how restricted superhuman beings are here on the planet. They're hedged around with rules and regulations. They can't interfere. Look at the commission which Jesus received from Emmanuel when he came down here as a man among men. All the prohibitions. You shan't do this and you shan't do that. We don't have any restrictions on us, except the restrictions of our own damn foolishness and smallness and mammalian characters. We can do anything that a man can do. We belong here, you see. We're totally evolutionary. Hence, we're totally unrestricted as to our efforts to be of service. This, to me, is something about God's will. I don't think God particularly cares whether I wear undershirts or not. I don't, as a matter of simplifying life. The fewer gadgets you have, the better I like it. I don't think he cares whether I travel this way or that way. I don't think he much cares what I do. I think he's concerned with how I do it. I think I could lose every game I ever played and still win if I was a good sport.
He loves
you. Yes. Let me tell you something else. The longer I live and the more I think about these papers, the more I think that we underestimate God. I think he's the most unstuffy being in the universe of universes. I think he's the most exciting being in the universe of universes. I think there are unpredictabilities in God, just as there are unpredictabilities, creativeness in people. I don't think God reacts exactly the same way to a given set of circumstances the way a machine does. That's the way paradise reacts, but not the way the Father or the Son would react. I think God has in his heart, if I may use that expression, an untold storehouse of surprises for those who love him. I think as a parent seeks to make gifts to children, I don't think we dream of the stores of truth and beauty and goodness which we're going to discover all the way from here to paradise and out again. I think God is going to be a delightful person to know. And I think the love of God is so great that it will take away all fear of his infinity. Even as the friendliness of Jesus was so disarming that men were never formal or stiff in his presence. People found Jesus to be a folksy sort of person. They didn't stand on ceremony with him. I don't think they were flip or fresh with a carpenter. But I don't think anybody would have hesitated to take off his necktie and coat and get comfortable. You know what I mean? Now, I don't think we'd sit around on our BVDs. That's taking it just a little bit too far. They were not flip with him, but they were not formal with him. Except on a few silly occasions, like Salome when she wanted special places of preferment for her kids. The will of God to me is a lot bigger than we realize. It's a lot roomier. I don't think it should make freaks out of us. Although I think it might inspire us to try to live uniquely, but not eccentrically. There's a great difference between uniqueness and eccentricity. Eccentricity is a lot of damn foolishness and ego expression. Uniqueness is simply you're expressing your personality, and it's unique. And I think the more man knows of God, the more individual that man will become, and yet the more fraternal he will become. It's like growing in two directions at the same time. As the papers say, when man consecrates his will to that of God, which is when man gives God all that he has, then does God make that man more than he is.
Where does that come? Where is that?
Somewhere in the Thought of Jester papers, I think. That's a direct quote. When man gives God all that he has, then does God make that man more than he is. Burke will find it. I find the easy ones. Burke finds the hard ones.
So, so long as I know where it's roughly. Well,
more outstanding as well as more commanding with the ground.
Sure. You grow as an individual, and yet you grow as a brother.
That's a good example of that.
turn your halo down, Berkey. It's getting a little bit blinding. I say turn your halo down. It's getting a little blinding.
I can't feel my wings.
I can't.
Your band creating a headache.
But I don't think God has anywhere near the same plans for different people. And let's get this down to where we can understand it better. God's plan for each man would be the adjuster's plan for that man. This now gets a little more understandable. And I don't think any two of these blueprints particularly resemble any others. Jesus didn't treat the 12 alike. He never said to James and Judas Alpheus, be good shepherds and feed my sheep. He said, look, boys, maybe you're going to go back to be fishermen. If so, be good fishermen. And remember, there is no such thing as sacred work and secular work to those who know God and desire to do his will. If being good fishermen is all that a man can do, that's all that God requires of that man. But he required a great deal more of Peter than he did of the Alpheus twin.
Personality.
Yes, and Peter had capabilities. I don't think Peter loved Jesus any more than the twins did. But Peter could do things that the twins couldn't do.
I wonder if there's any association between the personality bestowed by God and the thought of justice bestowed by God.
They're different, Wilma. Each thought adjuster is exactly like every other thought adjuster in terms of divinity. And in this respect, God is no respecter of persons.
In other words, you think the thought adjuster perhaps also grows after he becomes a part of us?
Well, the thought adjuster may have had previous experience, but in basic original divinity, they're all identical. Now, the personalities are just the opposite. No two are alike. Yes, correct. Or may be selected from among several. I think the personality, Wilma, in some unfathomable way is appropriate to the, is, I think, the personality that God bestows. And remember, he does this individually. This is not an automatic machine punch operation that's grinding out personality. I think in some way, this personality is uniquely appropriate to the potential for selfhood that's mobilized by the genes.
I know that too, and that's something that escaped me. I knew that years ago.
Now, the thought adjuster, as far as divinity is concerned, God is no respecter of persons. The adjusters are equally divine, but they're not equal in experience. Let's say that Peter's adjuster had experience in a spirit-fused survivor who was a great orator. Why waste that adjuster on one of the twins who couldn't give expression to this? Give it to Peter, who had the natural human aptitude for oratory.
Well, it would almost seem that these thought adjusters are free will creatures as we are. If they came by experience,
they're pre-will creatures.
Well, that's a good word.
They're pre-will creatures, yes. As they are pre-personal creatures.
Twelve
five.
What
does it say?
He says, if you as a personal creature have mind and will, the adjuster as pre-personal creature has pre-mind and pre-will.
Yes.
Oh, you just ran across that way. I thought you meant this other.
No, as Bill said that, I just thought.
No, the adjuster makes choices, but these choices cannot stand up against personality choices. They're subordinate to personality choices. The pilot can choose a course, but only the captain can authorize it. That's a good relationship to think of.
Bill, what is the plane on which God's fragments
I think it's all on the pre-personal level.
No, I mean to what group of
individuals? Havana natives.
Do they enjoy? See, you're about to get burnt with your epilepsy.
Boy, you sure
here.
Well, the Havana native who enters the mortal finality core has to fuse with the. I think, let me check this now.
But it isn't a fragment, the same fragment as we have.
It's a father fragment.
I didn't say thought adjuster, I said on.
All members of the mortal finality core are father fused.
But they are not endowed with thought adjusters.
I didn't say thought adjusters. I didn't qualify.
Well, they're not endowed with your father wife. Fragments, except
no.
Those that go into the knowledge core.
Come on. I don't want to fight. I just
want to
know what's the highest group of individuals.
Here's the quote. Havana natives must achieve certain experiential developments in liaison with evolutionary beings, which will create reception capacity for the bestowal of a fragment of the spirit of the Universal Father. The Mortal Finality Corps has as permanent members only such beings as have been fused with the spirit of the first source and center, or who, like the gravity messengers, innately embody the spirit of God the Father. Now, of these beings, only mortals and secondary midwayers are adjuster fused. The other members are fused with non-adjuster father fragments, whatever that means.
Whatever that means.
Yes.
But other than midwayers and mortals, those two would be the only ones that would be adjusted, limited. To
wait a minute now. I get
fragment.
Now. Wait a minute. The atoms too. The atoms are adjuster fused. Now adopted seraphim. There's an interesting thing about them. Yeah, it's in one or two places.
It's different.
I think it's in Guardian Angel. Page 1249, paragraph 3. Not all destiny guardians go into the mortal core, but of the seraphim who do go in, only destiny guardians are mustered into the primary or mortal core of the finality. And such pairs have engaged in the supreme adventure of identity at oneness. The two beings have achieved spiritual bi-unification on Seraphington prior to their reception into the finality core. In this experience, the two angelic natures, so complemental in all universe functions, achieve ultimate spirit two-in-oneness, repercussing in a new capacity for the reception of and fusion with a non-adjuster fragment of the Paradise Father. Now, the only other place they refer to spiritual biunification is the liaison that takes place between two creatures who trinitize, a third creature. They speak of that as a spiritual biunification. And this evidently is a biunification which takes place without the trinitization of a new being, but with the internal repercussion of a new capacity. What?
Well, what first referred to you a while ago brings out something. When thought adjusters indwell human minds, they bring with them the model careers, the ideal lives as determined and foreordained by themselves and the personalized adjusters of Salvation of Divinity, which have been certified by the personalized adjusters of Divinity. Thus, they begin work with a definite and predetermined plan for the intellectual and spiritual development of their human subjects. But it is not incumbent upon any human being to accept this plan. You're all subject to predestination, but it is not foreordained that you must accept this divine predestination.
That's correct.
How can you know?
We don't.
The process of accepting it.
I think what happens is this. We make bad choices, not necessarily sinful, but this automatically means that, well, let's symbolize the life of man as the adjuster conceived it, as a beautiful edifice. The east wing is now gone. We can't build it anymore. It's impossible. This choice which this man has made has foreclosed it. A little later on, you give up the west wing. We now still have the central structure. Pretty soon, we got to abandon the top five stories. Can't build that high in the time that's left. Pretty soon, we've got to abandon all but the first floor. And finally, the adjuster probably compromises by building a beautiful cellar. All that we've left. But I think each time man demolishes this plan, the adjuster reconstructs the best plan that can be built out of what's left. Now, I would compare the human life of Jesus to the human life of the average man as an indication of how much we botch up the adjuster's plan. In the human life of Jesus, I think a human being came pretty close to letting the adjuster build in accordance with the divine plan. And again, consider that little boy running around in Nazareth. There wasn't anything stuffy about him, was there? He was active, inquisitive, got into several normal jams. You know, he modeled, he broke one of the Mosaic commandments about thou shalt make no graven image, drew the picture of teacher on the floor, some of the members of the PTA, whose children were a little on the dull side, thought he was kind of pert and kind of uppity, and Jakey, who lived next door, saw to it that nobody picked on him. And if they took advantage of him, I imagine Jakey beat the hell out of him. And I'm all for that. He had lots of problems of adjustment. He discovered his sisters couldn't go to school. Well, he set up a home school. He lost his father. And they went through a lot of economic tribulation. And as you look at the life of the human Jesus, until about his 31st year, it begins to get a little beyond our comprehension, and that's the year they stop telling us much about him. They tell you where he went, but they don't tell you what he thought about. That's a blind spot. This is the adjuster's plan, I think, coming to fruit. And it's an interesting life, isn't it? It's just the opposite of a pious life, as would be described by most exponents of piosity, which is a synonym for pomposity a good deal of the time. A really pious person, I think, is unconscious of his piety. A pseudo-pious person is like the giver of alms, you know, who sounds the trumpet so that the populace will see the alms being given. In Jesus, I think you see, in the human Jesus, particularly before the Roman tour. He's getting a little bit outsized by that time, but if you consider the life of Jesus from his birth to about his mid-20s, this is an awfully fine life, a thoroughly worthwhile life, and yet not an extraordinary life. But you see the way he reacted to things. He didn't try to reform Nazareth and say, got to make the synagogues co-educational. No, he quietly set up a home school. Saw to it that his sisters were literate. He learned discretion. Got into one jam and had to be bailed out. You remember the time they wanted him to head up the zealot movement? Well, he had friends. And people like that will always have friends. whether it's the old Kazan and his younger brother James, or whether it's young Jakey, the stonemason's son. There's a real life, and it's an understandable life. It's a simple life. It's a good life, and very unstuffy.
Back to this edifice that you talked about a while ago.
Yeah.
The swing gone and all the bricks. And then
all we get left is a bomb shelter.
Wouldn't it be possible, or is it at all possible, to come back and make a club room out of the east wing instead of a terrific structure sticking off like the west side of
I don't think it takes the whole edifice to make it. I think with a well-decorated basement, it can be done. I'm minded of the statement in Genesis, which is reproduced in the Blue Book. It says, "And Abraham believed faintly." It does not say that the cosmic bookkeeper sneered at the smallness of the entry. No, it says, "And it was counted unto him for righteousness." You see, if they operated this universe on the basis of justice, I would give up my religion and be a Stoic. I would simply say, I now abandon all hope, and I will continue to live a moral life simply because I choose to live this way. But they tell me they don't run the show this way. They tell me it's a family, and it's actuated by love. And that there's an element called mercy. And so I continue to have hope.
And here you say to him in the back of the book, to the kingdom of God, I said it over before I spoke out loud, and I can't say it. Brother Man, I said it. You quoted the kingdom of God in something. The love of God and brotherhood of man. I had a list at home and all the places that are here. I got to find a book. Still in the verse 5, what you're looking for too?
No. No, I think you can make it with a well-decorated basement. As long as you leave the adjuster anything to work with. You can't destroy it all. But I don't think it requires the divine plan to get there. And I just compare the life of the earlier life of Jesus with any comparable human life that you might want to think of. And that's a fair comparison. Jesus a man versus any man. You better cut it off at about 25, though.
Fatherhood. You ought to temper it a little, even quicker than that.
Yeah.
The fatherhood of God.
Yes.
The brotherhood of God.
No, I think we can get there with even a part of a basement. If we've got the best-looking coal bin, this might make it. I don't think it takes a great deal. If there's something there that the adjuster's been a party to, which means that God has been a party to. If there's nothing, then there is nothing. I think so. Procrastination.
Yeah.
Problem avoidance.
Can you copy that whole? Both
of them. Unfairness. Ease seeking. Equivocation. They tell, I'm merely quoting the papers, where they tell us that the mansion worlds are principally occupied, the earlier ones, with the eradication of such animal vestigial traits as equivocation, procrastination, problem avoidance, unfairness, and ease-seeking. These they seem to regard as the cardinal weaknesses or sins of mankind.
I was hoping you'd mention something
I wasn't guilty of. It's, well, aren't they devastating them all? If they'd only stick to lurid things like adultery and, you know, things like that. Isn't that in the Mansion World Park too? That's worth finding, I think. I'll bet I don't find it.
You've got 2.5 minutes to find it.
Is that when we're going to quit?
I wonder if we can. Let's look. Page 551.
That's in the Mirage Life. I wouldn't have gotten to it for a while. What paragraph? Yeah. Paragraph 3. One of the purposes of the Marantia career is to effect the permanent eradication from the mortal survivors of such animal vestigial traits as procrastination, equivocation, insincerity, problem avoidance, unfairness, and ease-seeking. The Mansonia life early teaches the young Marantia pupils that postponement is in no sense avoidance. After the life in the flesh, time is no longer available as a technique of dodging situations or of circumventing disagreeable obligations. You can't count on death to bail you out anymore.
Bill, those things listed there, to me, do not affect me. Those are not the things, because they admit that on the first Mansion World we can have all these things.
Oh, sure.
There are other things, the more important.
Well, they tell us, they tell us that the keys of the kingdom of heaven are
sincerity
and more of same, and that we make progress therein by decisions and by more of same, which to me, I would translate those as saying, honesty and courage. If you have honesty and courage, you will grow. Because even if you start in the wrong direction, you'll learn. If you don't have any courage, you don't start. And if you're not honest, you won't learn. It takes the two.
Yeah. It takes service to mankind, the love of mankind to build a house.
Yes, I think you must be. Well, let's go back and use their word, sincerity. If a human.
I can do something wrong, Bill. I can do something wrong and be sincere.
Oh, certainly you can, and you'll learn if you're sincere, but if you're not sincere, you'll rationalize it. Yeah. If you're. I think you've got to have the two to get anywhere. If you don't make decisions, if you don't have any courage, you stand still. So how do you learn? And if you start in the wrong direction and you're insincere, dishonest, you'll refuse to learn. But if you're sincere and then move, then even if you're totally wrong to start with, you will learn. And eventually you'll write your course.
Bill, I get the idea. I might be completely wrong, but George Bateman said, you know, tore down that house in the basement, and he did well with the basement. He was wanting him to go back up, and he got tired with all the debt to build that pepper in my thing.
If you live long enough, but maybe death will prevent the
further. I'm going to live forever, buddy.
Well, I agree with you, but not here. Not here. You'll rebuild it on the Mansion World.
I'm going to live here long enough to have a trip to the high
plane ticket on that first trip to the moon, commercially. Excuse me.
We're far.
I hate like the devil to have to say this, but goodbye.
I'll see you then.
Mine's right. I hope to see you next time you get around.
Well, could be. I'll be here next month.
18th of September.
Oh, really?
Take care.
16th.
No fun.
My teacher's birthday is the reason
great.
I remember
real
the day.
How are you going?
You remember
going
the day.
Well, of course.
Huh? I don't have to shut up.
We'll get on in my room.
George, nice to see you.
Nice
right
to
here.
See you.
Awfully happy to see you.
Well, thank you.
Good Bill, you've no idea.
Cheers.
That's all I'm going to say. You have no idea.
Don't miss on the 16th. We'll sing Sweet Adeline. Yeah. We've covered a lot of territory this afternoon. Mind is all you have that's under your control.
The only thing.
Mm-hmm.
It is the only thing.
Mind is our tool.
Mind is the cosmic instrument.
Yep.
And that is.
You can destroy and warp mind. You can make mind ugly and evil. You can be defensive with mind. You can refuse to learn with mind. Or you can. You can say in your heart of hearts, mea culpa. You don't have to proclaim it to the world. And you can say, all right, teach me. But if you don't admit you're wrong, you deny yourself the capacity to learn what's right.